My castaway this week is a composer and conductor. After his parents fled from Nazi Germany, he grew up in California, where his skill as a jazz musician won him a job at MGM and led to 4 Oscars for his film scores. In the 60s, he turned his back on Hollywood and, as principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra, set out to establish himself as a serious musician, despite succumbing to the occasional appearance on the Morecambe and Wise show. For nearly 20 years now, he's worked with many of the world's most famous orchestras, particularly the Vienna Philharmonic, gradually losing his celebrity status in the process. He's had 4 wives, including Dori Previn and Mia Farrow, but remains grateful for his change of circumstances. It really is nice, he says, to be just considered a musician these days. He is Andre Previn. Is that to suggest, Andre, that you didn't enjoy your celebrity status?
Oh, I enjoyed it a great deal, but I'm not sure that I like the emphasis on the word just, as in just a musician.
Well, I'm quoting you.
Yes, I know you are. I know that's the deadliest thing to do of all. But I am pleased to be involved in music that is music for its own sake and not for the peripheral glamour of who's doing it.
You know? But you always seem to enjoy that glamour when it was around. You seem to be such an extrovert. One thinks of you in the late 60s, early 70s with your Indian-style jackets on, trendy flowered shirts.
Well, but weren't we all? I mean, I see pictures of even extremely dignified people from the 60s, and we all looked like ranging from interesting to twits, you know, so...
But what made it so novel for us was that you came from the classical world, as it were, but we knew you'd been in Hollywood, and therefore we knew you were accessible. That's what you were doing, really. You were bridging that gap for us. But, of course, the price you had to pay then for all of that was that the press were constantly camped on your doorstep, not just because of that, but also because you were married to a movie star, to Mia Farrow.
Right.
And what's more, you know, wildly avant-garde, you had children before you were married.
Right.
Did you accept then that kind of attention came with the territory, or was it always a miserable business?
And I thought it was very tough on Mia, who was then married to me, and our babies. And we tried our best to play it down. And I had fun once throwing a camera into a swimming pool. But I'm not really given to those things, and they don't come naturally to me. Although I did enjoy it a lot. And I got a lot of points from Mia for it.
But is that what you mean when you say that you're pleased to be considered a musician, and just for your music, as it were? Well, not just, as you say. But is that what you mean, that kind of price that you pay for being a celebrity was a bore?
Well, I think it's much nicer now that there is a great part of the audiences that don't know anything about my kids, don't know anything about my former marriages, and they're just taking me for what I do now, and that is a very happy circumstance.
And now you're melted down at Madame Tussauds.
Yes,
quite right.
You
really do
too.
Know you're safe. So 8 records, Andre, an impossibility for anyone, let alone a musician. How have you set about choosing them?
I tell you what, 8 is hopeless. I mean, you might be able to come up with 3 after a great deal of arguing, and it would be certainly easier to come up with 25. But 8 is right in the middle. It's too many to be exclusive and not enough. So these are the first 8 that I came up with.
Tell me about the first one.
The first one is the Beethoven Violin Concerto, which has a second movement of such unsurpassable serenity that it always, no matter what else is going on in anyone's life, it will give you a different perspective. And this particular performance is by Anna-Sophie Mutter, who is, well, I don't know anyone that plays the violin any better than this.
Thank you.
part of the second movement of Beethoven's violin concerto played by Anna-Sophie Mutter with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Beautiful, beautiful music, Andre Previn. Can music still move you to tears, does it?
Oh, yes, and how. When you're actually in the act of performing it, it doesn't tend to move you to tears because you are still in control of performing it. But certainly when I'm listening, it can really get to me.
When was the first time, do you remember, that you actually stood up, you know, very early on, I'm sure, in front of an orchestra and conducted it? When was that moment that you thought, this is what I want to do?
It was studio musicians in Hollywood who were sick of playing studio music, and they got together as an ad hoc orchestra, and they would ask anybody who wanted to or who could conduct to do that, and I remember doing that when I was about 18.
But was that a defining moment? Did you then know what I want to do with my life is
yes.
conduct? Because you had a choice. I mean, you could play, someone said you could play 11 instruments, is that right?
No, that is exaggerated by 10, but that's all right. no.
But you could play jazz and you can improvise and you could transcribe. I mean, you had a choice of careers.
Yes, I certainly have always written, and I was writing for a living then, and I've always been a fairly good pianist. And I play a couple of other instruments very badly, I hasten to add. But when I conducted, I suddenly thought the repertoire that I admire above all others is the orchestral repertoire. And so this was a good way for me to be a part of it always.
But when you made the great switch from Hollywood to classical music to the LSO, you must have stood up in front of the LSO time and again without really, I was going to say, quite knowing what you were doing. I mean, without really knowing the pieces.
No, that's not quite true. I may not have had a lot of empirical knowledge of the piece, but I like to think that I've never stood up in front of an orchestra without having had massive study time.
Because you do these days believe in an enormous amount of rehearsal, don't you?
Yes.
Particularly for very well-known pieces.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you explain that? Why?
Any great orchestra lives partially on the tried and true repertoire and then partially on new repertoire. The new repertoire tends to take a lot of technical time to prepare because it tends to be technically more difficult. Therefore, very often, there's a kind of unspoken feeling that, oh, well, if we're doing Beethoven 7, we can get that done in 45 minutes and spend the rest of the time on the new things. And I won't do that because I think that very often habit breeds all kinds of playing that you must really get rid of.
But interestingly, when you go on stage to play jazz, which you do still once a year, you go on tour, you presumably have a bunch of tunes and a vague idea of what you're going to do with them, but obviously, by definition, no rehearsal.
No, it's just, it's all improvised. What we have is a list of tunes. We have too many on the list, so we can choose and skip around. And a list of keys which we will probably play in. And after that, it just becomes a game.
But there's no jazz on your Desert Island Discs here. I wonder why that
no.
is.
No. I don't know. You know, it occurred to me when I looked at this list. I'm terribly fond of jazz. It moves me very much. It makes me happy. It makes me sad, all sorts of things. But if I'm reading the intent of Desert Island Discs right, it is records that are exclusively the ones you will hear for the rest of your days. And in that case, I would rather have compositions than improvisations.
Tell me about your second record.
Second record. Oh, well, this is the slow movement of Vaughan Williams' Fifth Symphony. And it so happens that it is the LSO conducted by me in this recording. I've always had a great predilection for British music, and that was apparent very early on in my life here. And I recorded all nine of the Vaughan Williams symphonies. And the fifth is the most touching for me and the most typical. And the slow movement I find really ravishing. And the LSO knows just how to play.
part of the third movement of Vaughan Williams' Symphony No. 5 in D, played by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by my castaway, Andre Previn. Going back to your very early days, to Berlin, where you were born at the end of the 20s, how soon was it recognised that Andreas, as you were christened, was going to be a musician?
Very early on. We had music in the house at all times. My father was a lawyer, very successful, and he liked to play the piano, amateur piano, but very good. So we had a house full of Lieder, Singer, and chamber music at all times, and I would be allowed to listen, which I did with great pleasure. And then I actually asked to have piano lessons, which is, in retrospect, a hateful thing for a child to do. But I did it not to get points, but because I really wanted it.
How old would you have been then?
5. And I was put in the conservatory when I was 6. I knew from that day on that I didn't know it precisely what, but I certainly knew I was going to be involved in music, yes.
So it was a comfortable existence, obviously, in Berlin. Everything was going well.
I mean, I was aware that we weren't at Butlins, if that's what you mean. But on the other hand, I was very young. I was a child. I was very involved in my music. And the horror that was going on to me was translated as a kind of adventure, you know. I didn't realize the implications of it.
Until you were expelled from the conservatory, weren't you?
Yes.
For being Jewish?
Yes, right. And then shortly after that, we fled to Paris and spent a year or so there.
How did you get out? How did the family get out?
It's one of those stories that it sounds like a film, but evidently my father was in his office and his secretary, quite white-faced, came in and said there was an SS man waiting to see him. And he said, if I leave with him, call my family. And the man came in and said, do you remember me? And my father, in all honesty, said, no. And he said, well, you defended me many years ago on a case. And he said, I'm going to do you a favor. Leave. Now. Tonight. And my father realized that this was quite obviously very deeply meant advice. And we left that night on the pretext of getting a weekend in Paris, which was still, they couldn't prevent that because there had been no war declared yet. So we went as a family to Paris with kind of weekend money, and my parents left absolutely everything, house, library, paintings, money, silver, whatever. And we went from there.
Never saw any of that stuff again, presumably.
No.
And you then went to New York, and mm-hmm. then very quickly after that, I think in 1939, to the West Coast.
Yes,
to Hollywood.
California, yes.
But how could your father make a living? He was a German lawyer, you said.
He was a German lawyer, and he did not speak English very well. He obviously couldn't pass the bar. It's a whole different set of rules and laws. And so he used his love and his knowledge of music. And suddenly, if you think about it, the detriment of having a German accent was a great plus if you were going to be the neighborhood German piano teacher, you see. So he taught piano, and it was a kind of act of heroism on his part, which I didn't realize till I was adult, you know, that there he was one day with his own law office, and a couple of months later he was teaching untalented children in the neighborhood.
What about your musical education? Did that come to a halt as a result?
No. I was introduced quite rapidly to some very good teachers and went on from there. And I went to a perfectly straightforward, normal high school.
Beverly Hills High. Sounds Beverly really Hills glamorous High. Now. I don't know whether it was that.
Well, the only thing memorable in retrospect about Beverly Hills High School, which will give you an idea of what it was, is that it had a student parking lot, which was slightly bigger than Hampstead, I think. It was extraordinary. They took it for granted you would have your own car, which I did not. Then, of course, during my very last year in Beverly Hills High School, I had already done some peripheral work in radio stations and things as an arranger, as a pianist, and whatever, and got a call to do piecework at film studios, and that's how that started.
Record number 3, tell me about that.
Record number 3 is the Debussy Afternoon of a Faun. It's a piece that if you study it very carefully, there really isn't a single solitary extraneous note in it. There's nothing that's put in just for sound, just for show. It's a perfect piece. On this record, it's conducted by a man who turned out to be my conducting teacher, Pierre Monteux, and what he didn't know about French music or about any music wasn't worth knowing.
part of Debussy's prelude à l'après-midi d'un faune, played by the LSO, conducted by Pierre Monteux, the teacher of my castaway, André Previn. You quickly became a kind of wunderkind in Hollywood, didn't you, André? What sort of things did you do?
Well, you know, they had a wunderkind of the week there. It's not really that much of a... I had a wonderful time. And there's all that soft weather and all those pretty girls, and it was wonderful.
And all those stars. I mean, you rubbed shoulders with all that. You were on swimming pool terms, I think, is the phrase.
That's a nice phrase. Yes, that's quite true.
Debbie Reynolds and Esther Williams, famous for her swimming.
No, I was never in a pool with Esther Williams. That would have been a nice thought, but no. but I was great friends with a lot of wonderfully talented people.
And the story goes that you were propositioned by Ava Gardner, but too naive to recognize what was on
offer.
Yes,
that's a story of enormous regret and unsurpassable stupidity. but yes, that's quite true. I didn't get it at the time, and I've thought about it ever since.
What did she say?
No, easy come, easy go.
Give me the line. I mean, what did she say?
I don't think I'm allowed to give you the line.
I thought she just asked you to drive her home. You know?
Oh, yes. I thought you meant her ultimate reaction, which is unbroadcastable, if there's such a word. But I met a lot of fascinating people, you know, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, and really wonderful people who left their mark on me.
They, of course, were in their heyday,
and
older than you. I mean, you would have been very young. It must feel like a lifetime ago when you talk about it.
No, not like a lifetime ago. It feels like another life, completely. It's very hard for me to remember walking into the studio gates every year in that blazing sunshine and ready to go to work on a film.
You were nominated, I think, for 13 Oscars, but you certainly won 4, didn't you, for Gigi and Porgy
yes,
and Bess.
And lost 9.
Lost 9. But I must ask you about your very first original score, which you wrote when you were 20 in 1949 for a Lassie film, wasn't it?
Yes.
When was the last time you heard it?
Then. It is, curiously enough, somebody told me it was out on home video, but I haven't quite got the nerve to look for it. It was a film about the story of a disappointed opera singer who'd had a loss in the family and found her will to live back in the Ozark Mountains. Now, that is as much as I understood then and as much as I understand now. And I loved writing the music because she sang a bit and there was some incessant barking. And almost no one spoke, but there were great panoramas of mountains and meadows.
So the music was very important.
Yes, so, you know, I just wrote reams of music, which I was very happy to do.
But in the end, despite all the Oscars and all the stars and so on, you wanted out because you said that you got tired of doing something that didn't frighten you. I mean, you said you enjoyed walking through the door every day, but then perhaps it did just become too matter-of-fact.
Well, I don't think you can do good work as an artist if the work doesn't worry you, if the work doesn't really actually frighten you. And I got to the point with film music where it didn't really scare me because I knew I could do it well enough to get by. And I didn't like that. I think that when you are working with something as remarkable as music, I think the music has to frighten you. I think you have to be up for days and nights and weeks worrying about it. And so I knew I couldn't achieve that in Hollywood, and so I got out.
Next record.
Next record is the beginning of the Brahms Fourth Symphony. Again, I'll have to say the same thing that I said about the last record. It's a perfect piece. The Brahms Fourth is the most remarkable structure. It is heartbreakingly beautiful, and it is also a perfectly engineered piece. It is one of the great pieces of all time.
Thank you.
The opening of Brahms Symphony No. 4, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. How difficult was it to throw off that Hollywood reputation when you began to try and create your classical one?
It didn't last too long, because after a while, even unimaginative critics get tired of criticizing you for the same reason, which is reasons they didn't like you for what you did years before. And I remember once I got a bad review because the man simply hadn't liked the concert that night, instead of hadn't liked it because of what I used to do. And I thought, well, now that I'm getting bad reviews on my own, I'm going to be a success.
Do you remember the moment when the call came from the LSO?
Yes, indeed. I had been here, I'd made a couple of records with them. I loved the way they played, as indeed, why shouldn't I? And a little delegation came around and they to the hotel I was in, and they asked me whether I would consider being principal conductor.
Because they'd elected you themselves, as well. It was a very democratic
yes.
business, wasn't it?
Yes.
This was the orchestra, members of the orchestra asking you.
Absolutely.
Great
and
comment.
I was completely flabbergasted and said yes so quickly that it must have shocked them.
So you came to live here. You bought a house in the countryside. You said earlier on that you had a feeling for English music. Was it enhanced by that whole experience of
Oh, country? Yes. Yes, I think so. I think that there is a whole side of English music that is enhanced by life here. I mean, I think that, for instance, Vaughan Williams' music and a lot of Britain's music is translatable into certain kinds of natural phenomena that you see here. I mean, whether it's the sea with Britain or the kind of rolling hills for Vaughan Williams or the bustle for Walton or whatever, it's very indigenous to this country. And I had always liked the music. I liked the music and admired it and studied it long before I ever came here. So that the appointment to the LSO simply meant that I was given indulgence to make this kind of predilection of mine public.
Let's have some more music.
The next record is something that I've conducted, but I really chose it for a combination of the playing of the orchestra, the playing of the cello soloist, who is Franz Bartholomew, who is the principal cello of the Vienna Philharmonic, and the piece, Richard Strauss's Don Quixote, Don Quixote, Don Quixote, I don't care where you come from. And it is a piece that I find quintessential Strauss, and of the non-operatic Strauss, the most beautiful.
The end of Richard Strauss's Don Quixote, played by the Vienna Philharmonic with the cellist Franz Bartholomew, conducted by my castaway, Andre Previn. You said that the Vienna Philharmonic is the most beautiful sounding orchestra in the world, and I think many people would agree. Why do you think it is so rounded and so cohesive?
Well, they have a tradition of string playing and of horn playing, which has gone back generations. There are principal players in that orchestra that are third generation. You know, where their fathers and grandfathers already had those jobs. They do also work in the most beautiful hall in the world, the Musikverein. And so they make this ravishing sound, especially for the repertoire that is undeniably theirs.
But you were mentioning to me earlier that the other day you played some Vaughan Williams with them and they'd not heard of Vaughan Williams before.
That's right. That's right, quite right. I've decided that with that string section, which is really quite inimitable, that it would be fun for me to do the Vaughan Williams Talus Fantasy with them and one of my subscription concerts in Vienna, and we did it. They didn't know it, but they played it very beautifully. They said to me, this Vaughan Williams, has he written anything else? And then, is Thomas Talus a contemporary of his? And I kept wincing and trying to explain no, but then, you know, if you went to the LSO and said, shall we play something of Pfitzner's or of Franz Schmidt? They wouldn't know it either. It is continually astonishing to me, the amount of geographical boundary that exists with music, you know, where people know very well certain kinds of localized music and nothing of the other.
But going back to the Vienna Phil, you said that that they are the orchestra least suited to those early instrument frauds, which is uncharacteristically biting of you. What is it that you don't like about the attempt to play Mozart and Haydn, as the composers themselves might have heard it?
Well, I tell you what. First of all, the word fraud is over the top, and I will temper that. For me, the early instrument movement is way overdone. I was talking about it with Kurt Mazur, who is of the old school German conductor and who is now the music director of the New York Philharmonic. And he said, no, I approve of all of that, but they must not tell me that the way that I want to hear Mozart and Haydn is wrong or that I shouldn't play it. And yet, even when the Vienna Philharmonic plays Mozart and Haydn, which they do with me very often, somebody in the press will say, if you still like this kind of Mozart and Haydn, it was gorgeous. I tend to get kind of crazed about it because I think that it is simply not a beautiful sound. They take such care and go to such trouble to make sure it's out of tune. I don't know. I don't condone it and I don't understand it.
Record number 6.
Mozart's G minor symphony, number 40. And this is conducted by a man who, for Mozart, was my idol, Bruno Walter. And he most certainly would not, even if he'd had access in those days to the old instruments, he wouldn't have bothered because he wanted it to be as beautiful as possible at all times because he thought that Mozart, who was an angel, would have deserved that.
Of Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor, played by the Columbia Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Bruno Walter. I have to ask you, although it was many, many years ago, that very famous appearance of yours on Morecambe and Wise,
yes,
as Mr. Andrew Preview, I think they insisted on calling you, with Mr. Eric Morecambe at the piano, Grieg's Piano Concerto. Have you ever watched it since?
I watched it once since. I was given a knighthood, and when the British ambassador to the United States gave me a party for that, at the end of his speech, he said, I have a surprise for you, he said to me, and he ran for this august assemblage. He ran the Morecambe and Wise show, which was extremely good-natured of him and very funny, and I saw it for the first time in many, many years, you know, in 25 years. Mm. And I did love both Eric and Ernie very much, and I thought it was funny.
You were very good. You were very straight-faced. You never once sort of winked at the camera.
Well, Eric was very smart. He said, have you ever done anything like this before? And I said, no, of course not. And he said, well, the trick is that the three of us must be the only people up here who do not think this is funny. We have to play this absolutely straight. If you begin to intimate that you know this is funny, it won't be funny. Mm. And I took his advice and had a wonderful time with him.
You spent 25 years as a musical director of one orchestra or another, but these days you're freelance, you go where you fancy or where you're invited. Do you prefer that?
There are many things about being a music director that I miss. But on the other hand, to be freelance and to go to the great orchestras of the world, which I am very lucky in being able to do, is great fun. And also it means that I don't have to worry about fundraising or ladies' committees or shop stewards.
Next record.
The next record is one of the interludes from Britain's Peter Grimes. It's a stunning piece of work and very, very dramatically moving and emotionally touching. And my admiration of it never diminishes. Thank you.
part of the first interlude of Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes, played by the orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, conducted by Benjamin Britten. On the personal front now, André Previn, you're married to your fourth wife, Heather, and you have been for 14 years now. Children, you've got a young son, haven't you?
Yes, we have a 12-year-old son.
So how many children does that make that you have altogether?
Four sons and three daughters. Mm-hmm. And my adopted Vietnamese daughters, which adds another three.
Right. So there we are. And are any of the children musical?
My youngest, my 12-year-old, Lucas, started playing the guitar, and he turned out to be really gifted for it. So he first played classical guitar, and then he wanted an electric guitar, and now, although he flirts around with rock and all that, he is a really good guitarist.
So he might be the one of all of them to follow professionally. And you live about an hour's drive out of New York in Bedford Hills, although Heather, your wife, is English. Did you become disenchanted with this country for some reason?
Only professionally. It was too impractical. And also where we lived, it was ravishingly beautiful, but it took longer and longer and longer to get into London. And so I thought it was wiser of me to find a house in the country in America and come to England a great many times a year, which I've done. And it really has turned out, just from a point of mechanics, to be a lot easier.
Tell me about your last record.
As you know, I'm a participant in a great deal of chamber music every year, and I find that a complete necessity for my well-being. And this is a string quartet, which is, of course, the kind of chamber music that I cannot take part in, but it is the greatest part of chamber music, and for me, at least, the greatest string quartet ever written is the Beethoven Opus 131, number 14 in C-sharp minor, and this is one of the movements played by the Alban Berg Quartet.
The opening of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14 in C-sharp minor, Opus 131, played by the Alban Berg Quartet. Well, you've complained that eight records aren't enough, André, but now you've got to say, if you could only take one, which would it be?
If I only took one? Of these? Of these eight?
You can't have another one.
I guess I would take the Mozart Symphony No. 40.
The Brunewalter?
Yeah.
What about your book?
Well, the complete short stories about Chekhov, that would be nice to have. That's a lot to read, and it never fails to be moving.
What about your luxury?
Well, I said I wanted a piano, and I was told that I couldn't have a piano because it had to be a practicality.
Well, you can have a piano as long as you promise not to shelter underneath it. I think that's the rule.
Oh,
I haven't
got
the rules with me.
I can't sit under it.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's an easy promise to make. Yes, I won't sit under it, but I would like a piano, yes.
And we'd never know if you did anyway, would we? André Previn, Sir André Previn, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.